This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Nora Lashi on the status of her father's case. Along with four others, he was convicted of providing material support in the form of humanitarian aid to Hamas. It's a highly political case in which the odds were stacked greatly against these five individuals. We'll also hear excerpts from a recent event at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, marking 30 years of incarceration for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Interestingly, 2 days before the event, which had been planned for several months, the Philadelphia District Attorney announced that they would no longer seek the death penalty in Abu-Jamal's case. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've covered the use of high-tech weaponry against protesters, from so-called less lethal munitions to long-range acoustic devices. Law enforcement in Great Britain is testing a new weapon for their arsenal, a shoulder-mounted laser that emits a blinding light capable of repelling protesters. The technology was developed by a former Royal Marine commando. It temporarily impairs the vision of anyone who looks at it. The British-based developer, Photonic Security Systems, hopes to offer the laser to shipping companies for the purpose of deterring pirates. The laser, resembling a rifle and known as an SMU-100, can dazzle and incapacitate targets up to 500 meters away, with a wall of light up to 3 square meters. It comes equipped with an infrared scope to detect pirates in conditions with poor visibility. The cost is £25,000, or approximately $38,000. Looking at the intense beam causes a short-lived effect similar to staring at the sun, forcing the target to turn away. Photonic Security Systems Managing Director Paul Kerr says that the laser gives police an intimidating visual deterrent. He's told the Sunday Times, quote, "If you can't look at something, you can't attack it." Since this August, UK Metropolitan Police have been looking into new forms of non-lethal equipment, with the limited range of tasers and CS gas, leaving what they call a capability gap. Scientists there believe that the use of lasers has merit and that it will be likely piloted by at least one police force. They say they will have to be satisfied that the technology does not cause long-term health damage before it can be approved by the Home Secretary. According to the Sunday Times, other technology being considered includes wireless electronic interceptors that can be fired at greater distance than tasers and long-range chemical irritant projectiles. The Metropolitan Police is exploring the possibility of buying 3 water cannons at a cost of £4,000 or $6,000. Referring back to these new lasers, it seems that all a protester would need to do in this situation to protect him or herself is to carry a medium-sized pocket mirror to reflect laser beam back into the eyes of the police, making this a dangerous situation for everyone involved. We've discussed the use of predator drones to assassinate individuals in war zones and recently a U.S. citizen. This technology, designed to be used in warfare, has creeped slowly into the lives of American citizens on U.S. soil. Predator B drones. These unmanned aircraft have extremely sophisticated sensors and are the spy drone that has helped revolutionize modern warfare. Flying out of earshot and out of sight, they can watch a target for 20 hours nonstop, much longer than police helicopter or manned aircrafts can. They are used in manhunts, hostage situations, and other difficult cases. The drones belong to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which operates 8 Predators on the country's northern and southwestern borders to search for illegal immigrants and smugglers. The previously unreported use of its drones to assist local, state, and federal law enforcement has occurred without any public acknowledgement or debate. Congress first authorized the purchase of unarmed predators by Customs and Border Protection back in 2005. They have been flown in many areas across the country by federal as well as state and local law enforcement and emergency responders. But former Representative Jane Harman, who sat on the House Homeland Security Intelligence Subcommittee at the time and served as its chairwoman from 2007 until early this year, said that no one ever discussed using predators to help local police serve warrants or do other basic work. In 2008 and 2010, Harman helped fight efforts by Homeland Security to use imagery from military satellites in domestic terrorism investigations. Congress blocked the proposal on the grounds that it would violate the Posse Comitatus Act, which bars the military from taking a police role on U.S. soil. Supporters of the Predator drones claim that the high-resolution cameras, heat sensors, and sophisticated radar on the border protection drones can help track criminal activity in the United States, just as the CIA uses Predators and other drones to spy on militants in Pakistan, nuclear sites in Iran, and other targets around the globe. For decades, U.S. courts have allowed law enforcement to conduct aerial surveillance without a warrant. They have ruled that what a person does in the open, even behind a backyard fence, can be seen from a passing airplane and is not protected by privacy laws. But from a constitutional and privacy standpoint, using predator drones makes it far easier to spy on citizens than is currently possible and greatly increases the chance that our law enforcement will abuse this spying power. Once again, we see the continual blurring of military and domestic law enforcement practices. Last week, the Fifth Circuit dismissed the appeal for the Holy Land Foundation case. This decision affirmed the conviction of Ghassan Elashi, the co-founder of the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development. As many listeners may know, the Holy Land Foundation was considered the largest Muslim charity in the United States before the Bush administration shut it down after the September 11 attacks. In May 2009, a federal judge in Dallas handed down sentences ranging from 15 to 65 years in prison to five of the charity's founders and former fundraisers. Over a year before, a federal jury had returned guilty verdicts on all 108 counts against the foundation and the five former officers on charges of providing material support to Hamas after the U.S. government designated it a foreign terrorist organization in 1995. During that trial, the prosecution used unrelated video of suicide bombers to emotionally sway the members of the jury. Ghassan Elashi was then sentenced to 65 years in prison for providing material support in the form of humanitarian aid to Sagat committees, Palestinian charities in the West Bank and Gaza, that prosecutors were alleging were fronts for Hamas. Ghassan is being held in the Communications Management Unit in Marion, Illinois. Noor Elashi joins us now to give an update on the case and where we go from here. Noor is the author of the book, Eyes Like My Father, A Daughter's Narrative of Displacement. Noor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be back.
And first, I'd like to express how disappointed we are in the outcome of this appeals case. I'm sure you must be too. Can you briefly tell us how the appellate lawyers framed the basis for the appeal?
One of the main arguments that my father's attorneys, which include John Klein and Linda Moreno and some other attorneys, a superb defense team, one of the arguments that they made was that USAID, which is an American government agency, sent charity and money to the same exact Zakat committees, which are these distribution centers in Palestine, that the Holy Land Foundation sent charity to. So the Holy Land Foundation, which is a charity that my father co-founded, was their main charge. They were charged with giving material support in the form of humanitarian aid to these Zakat committees, which the prosecutors were claiming were fronts for Hamas. But in the appeal, one of their main arguments was that these Zakat committees received charity from many NGOs, including an American government agency. Another main argument during the appeal was that for the first time in American history, an expert witness who was an Israeli intelligence officer who testified under a fake name was allowed to testify under a pseudonym. And this was the first time in American history that this was allowed. And so this was, of course, included in the appeal as being extremely unconstitutional, and it stripped away the defense's right to confront the witness. And so all of these things during the appeal, unfortunately, were justified by the Fifth Circuit and were said, basically, they affirmed all of the convictions and they dismissed the appeal entirely. But those were a couple of the main strong points.
Now, those are compelling points, especially the first, that USAID has given money to the Zakat committees. Did the government respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, the government's main argument, even throughout the first trial and the second trial, was that American government agencies like USAID and other NGOs actually were not aware that these Zakat committees were fronts for Hamas, but that the Holy Land Foundation and its members were aware and that there was a conspiracy to win the hearts and minds of the Palestinians and through this charity work and turn them to violence. And so this was the nature of the arguments, which baffled many people who were in trial during that time.
And of course, we see the use of conspiracy used all the time in what are purely political cases such as this one. Really, conspiracy not difficult to prove and lengthens sentences so long. How is your father doing right now?
Well, my father, you know, although this has been like almost a decade that we've been going through this, this kind of news does not get any easier. I mean, I actually heard about this through an email from my father's attorney during my lunch break, and the last thing I wanted to do at that point was go back to work. But with my family, with the family of the other members of the Holy Land Five, all we can do is we can stay strong and continue to move on. I mean, but the most painful part for me is the limited communications that I have with my father. He's currently in a communications management unit.
Is he still in Marion, Illinois?
Still in Marion, Illinois, which has been called Guantanamo North, most recently by NPR. But because they house mostly Middle Eastern and Muslim inmates. But, you know, he actually also recently had a phone call ban because my father, you know, put his name on a yoga mat, and that was considered destruction of government property. And so we were unable to really communicate with him over the last few weeks, and then we weren't sure if we were going to hear from him right after the appeal. But thankfully, he called me a few days after this news, and during our 15-minute phone call, the first in several weeks, you know, he told me something that I think really makes a lot of sense. And he says, you know, the politics of this country are not on our side, and if we'd been anywhere else, we'd be honored for our work. So I think he really puts things into perspective there.
That's right. And you're speaking, of course, of the humanitarian aid that the Holy Land Foundation provided for years. How is the rest of your family doing, Noor?
The rest of my family, you know, again, when I first heard the news, I'm in New York. The rest of my family, I have a sister who lives in Maine. I have the rest of my family in Dallas mostly. And I called them the night that I heard the news. And they were all kind of consoling each other and very devastated, for sure. And we went through it so much. We've been through, you know, first the accusations during the 1990s, then the arrests, the indictments, the major shutting down of the HLF, the Bush administration announced to the entire country and the entire world. You know, the first trial, the hung jury, the second trial, the sentencing of my father to 65 years in prison. I mean, we've been hearing this news over and over and over again, and it doesn't get any easier. But there's so much more that's going to happen. Our defense attorneys are not going to quit. They will, in fact, plan to ask the entire panel of appellate judges to rehear the case. And then they plan on, if they deny, or if that petition is denied, they will ask the Supreme Court. Of course, they'll take the case to the Supreme Court. So
yes,
we're going to continue to fight this battle, and we're not going to quit. We know that, like my father said, the politics of this country are not on our side. the foreign policy and politics of this country have always been very favorable towards Israel. It's become a crime to send humanitarian aid to Palestinians, and this is why my father's in prison right now.
Noor, when we last spoke with you, you were working on a book, Eyes Like My Father, A Daughter's Narrative of Displacement. How is the book coming along? Has it been published?
Yeah, the book is actually going really well. It has not been published yet, but I'm working hard on it. I'm, you know, at the moment searching for agents and trying to sell it. I've gotten a lot of good responses when I talk about this book. And you know, the book is going to be a kind of breakthrough father-daughter memoir about the last 10 years of my life. I'm kind of an Arab-American young woman living in this post-9/11 world as her father is prosecuted and sort of drugged through the justice system until he's finally sentenced to 65 years. But it's just also about an unbreakable hope that exists not only in myself, but my family and my father.
Noor, what kind of people support movement has there been around this case? I know that the National Lawyers Guild, our members are aware of the case. Is there a website where listeners can go for more information?
You know, there is, but it's currently under construction, and it has been under construction for some time. I've written a few pieces on Counterpunch. In fact, I wrote one very recently. But the website is freedomtogive.com. Again, it's under construction. But once it's back up, then I think it'll be a very useful tool, although it hasn't been updated for some time. As far as support from national organizations, yeah, certainly we've gotten support from the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as many other organizations that have actually signed on to the appeal appellate brief.
We will definitely put a link to your site when it's up and running and share information about this. You get to speak to your father. How many phone calls a week is he allowed? Two, three?
My father gets two phone calls a week, but because I have a sister who lives in Maine, then I pretty much hear from him once every 2 weeks for 15 minutes. All phone calls are live monitored from Washington, D.C., and have to be scheduled in advance.
And his spirits, understandably, sad news right now, but it sounds as though he's been a solid force in your life.
Yes, absolutely. You know, he doesn't regret anything that he's done. And, I mean, of course, when I spoke to him, his voice was trying to be as strong as it possibly can. We are each other's pillars who sort of keep each other standing tall and keep each other going, and that applies for both he and I and he and the rest of my family. And so he doesn't regret anything that he's done. He's very proud of his work. And like I said in my op-ed, his time in prison hasn't stifled his passion for human rights. And in fact, when I've asked him, what are you going to do when you get out? He said, I'm going to walk all the way to Richardson, Texas, holding a sign that says, End the Occupation of Israel.
Oh, Noor, that's very moving. And I'm sure you'll be walking with him, as will many of us.
Absolutely.
We are really looking forward to the publication of your book. Let us know when that happens. We'll have you on again. And we are sending our warmest wishes to you and your family and your father. Thank you so much for being on again.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Bye. On December 7th, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office announced that it will not seek another death sentence for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Under Pennsylvania law, Abu-Jamal will now be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The National Lawyers Guild commented that while there is overwhelming doubt about what the state claims to be the facts in the case, even those allegations never supported a capital charge. That it has taken 3 decades to remove death from the table is simply astonishing. Procedural irregularities plagued his case from the outset, including blatant constitutional violations, from the judge allowing the prosecution to admit evidence of his affiliation with the Black Panther Party, in violation of the Supreme Court case Dawson v. Delaware, to the use of a faulty sentencing form that misled jurors during the penalty phase, in violation of the Supreme Court case Mills v. Maryland. A great deal of relevant evidence was never reviewed by any court, much less presented to a jury. This evidence includes several photographs of the crime scene, which impeach the testimony of a police officer who was a key eyewitness, and proof that another individual was present and fled the scene of the shooting. Abu Jamal was charged at a time when, it was later revealed, there was extensive corruption within the Philadelphia Police Department. In 1995, then-District Attorney Lynn Abraham promised the city that she would dismiss any case in which there was evidence of police perjury or purposeful misreporting of facts. Given the history of police misconduct in Philadelphia when Abu Jamal was arrested, and the specific instances of police perjury in this case, the National Lawyers Guild urged current DA Seth Williams to act on his predecessor's unfilled pledge. 2 days after the DA's announcement, and commemorating International Human Rights Day, a free forum was held at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia to mark the 30th anniversary of Mumia Abu-Jamal's incarceration. 1,200 supporters met to reinvigorate the movement for justice for Abu-Jamal and to say no to life in prison for this political prisoner. Quote, because for 30 years Abu Jamal has been unconstitutionally imprisoned in death row torture, justice for Mumia will not be served by life imprisonment, but rather by freedom, said Dr. Johanna Fernandez, professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York, and a co-producer of the forum. Fernandez wrote and produced a documentary, which debuted at the Constitution Center in 2010, on Abu Jamal's case. We go now to hear several highlights from the December 9th event. We will first hear from Ramona Africa, the sole adult survivor of the 1985 MOVE massacre.
Long live John Africa. I have some serious information for you today. We understand Seth Williams on Wednesday made a statement that he was deciding not to pursue the death penalty for Mumia. And he had Maureen Faulkner by his side. We understand exactly what is happening here. We're not fooled, we're not tricked one bit. I know, because of personal experience, my family's personal experience, who these people are and what they do. They hate Mumia more today than they have the past 30 years. They are furious at the international support that Mumia has. They are furious at the strong, consistent movement around Mumia. They are furious that he's a black man that stands for truth as opposed to the lies of this system. They are furious, and they will never do anything in Mumia's so-called interests. Everything they do is in their interest, and they cannot be trusted. I heard Maureen Faulkner say she was glad that Mumia was now going into general population because now he'll be with his own kind, thugs and murderers, and he will have less protection on him. Now that's what she said. She also said that Mumia is, closer today to meeting his ultimate judge than ever before. MOVE ain't stupid. We know what we're hearing. We have not forgotten how this government killed George Jackson and tried to convince people. How they tried to pay and offer bribes to several people to take Leonard Peltier out of jail. We have not forgotten that. We know what we're looking at. We know that these people, if they can't get you one way, they'll try to get you another. That's who they are. That's what they do. They know they can't win by just out and out, you know, saying they want to execute Mumia, trying to get another hearing to put Mumia, keep Mumia on death row and execute him. But that doesn't mean that they have given up their plans to try to kill Mumia. And we need to keep that in mind. Mumia is our brother. And we understand that while we're not saying we want him on death row or that he should be executed, you know, what we are saying is that we recognize the danger that Mumia is in general population like that. A lot of people love Mumia, respect Mumia, that's true, because I've heard that throughout today. But it only takes one. It only takes one. And we know that there are plenty of people in prison who will take the promise of release or money and do whatever this system wants. We know that. We need to be aware of this. We need to be ever vigilant of our brother. And when you talk about asking questions, ask yourself, why are these people so desperate, so adamant about killing Mumia Abu-Jamal? They never forget his name. And they say it's because, well, he killed one of our own. He killed a cop. But none of them can tell you the name of people accused of or convicted of killing a cop 6 months ago, a year ago, 3 years ago. They don't know their name. Can't tell you their names. But they know the name of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Now, why are they so hate-filled about me? Why don't they feel the same way about the man accused of killing their president, John F. Kennedy, or his brother, Robert Kennedy, you know, or the man that killed John Lennon, accused of killing John Lennon? Or what about baby killers? You don't see the same adamant, you know, attitude about people accused of those crimes as you see coming from these people about killing Mumia. And MOVE know what we're looking at. We've dealt with these people for a long time. These are the people, like was said earlier, that dropped the bomb on our family, burnt babies alive, burnt our sisters and brothers alive, our animals alive. We know what we're dealing with. And people need not hallucinate about this. Mumia, you know, he is important to all of us. He's our brother. And we are very, very concerned about him. And we intend to be ever vigilant on our brother. And we ain't never going to stop fighting for our brother. When you're innocent and, okay, you get off of death row, fine. But life in prison without parole is not acceptable. It is not acceptable. Moon people and true Mumia supporters ain't never going to stop fighting for our brother. We ain't never going to stop confronting this rotten ass system. We want to put an end to this kind of injustice. That's what the MOVE organization is committed to. We're committed to bringing our brother home, and we're committed to continuing to fight to bring this system down. They want to bring our brother Mumia down. They want to try to bring the MOVE organization down. Well, we intend to bring them down. And just as determined as they are to get their way, to win this little contest that they feel like they're involved in, because that's how they see it. Just as determined as they are to have their way, we have to be twice, three times, 10 times more determined to put things right, to fight and never stop fighting to put things right. That's MOVE's position. That is MOVE's position. So we say, on the MOVE, long live revolution, long live the spirit of resistance, long live our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, long live all freedom fighters, all those who dare to fight.
That was Ramona Africa at the National Constitution Center on December 9. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We now hear from former poet laureate Amiri Baraka.
Somebody go with America. All thinking people oppose terrorism, both domestic and international, but one should not be used to cover the other. Somebody blew up America. They say it's some terrorist, some barbaric Arab in Afghanistan. It wasn't our American terrorists, it wasn't the Klan or the skinheads, or the them that blows up churches or reincarnates us on death row. It wasn't Trent Bach or David Duke or Giuliani or Schumer. Helms, the terrible Helms did. It wasn't the gonorrhea in costume, the white cheek diseases that have murdered black people, terrorized reason and sanity, most of humanity as they please. They say, who say? Who do the saying? Who is the pain? Who tell the lies? Who in disguise? Who had the slaves? Who got the books? Out the books. Who got fat from plantations, who genocided Indians, tried to waste the black nation? Who live on Wall Street, the first plantation? Who cut your nuts off? Who raped your mom? Who lynched your pop? Who got the tar? Who got the feathers? Who had the match? Who set the fires? Who killed and hired? Who say they God and still be the devil? Who the biggest only? Who the most goodest? Who do Jesus resemble? Who created everything? Who the smartest? Who the greatest? Who the richest? Who say you ugly and ain't a good lookingness? Who defined art? Who defined science? Who made the bombs? Who made the guns? Who bought the slaves? Who sold them? Who call you them names? Who say Dahmer wasn't insane? Who stole Puerto Rico? Who stole the Indies, the Philippines, Manhattan, Australia, and the Hebrides? Who forced opium on the Chinese? Who owned the buildings? Who got the money? Who think you funny? Who lock you up? Who owned the papers? Who owned the slave ship? Who run the army? Who was the fake president? Who the ruler? Who the banker? Who owned the mine? Who twists your mind? Who got bread? Who need peace? Who you think need war? Who own the oil, who do no toil, who own the soil, who is not a nigger, who is so great ain't nobody bigger. Who own the city, who own the air, who own the water, who own your crib, who rob and steal and cheat, murder, make lies the truth, who call you uncouth? Who live in the biggest house, who do the biggest crime, who go on vacation anytime? Who kill the most niggers, who kill the most Jews, who kill the most Italians, who kill the most Irish, who kill the most Africans, who kill the most Japanese, who kill the most Latinos? Who owned the ocean? Who owned the airplanes? Who owned the malls? Who owned television? Who owned radio? Who ain't what he even known to be owned? owners that ain't the real owners. So we're on the suburbs. Who suck the cities?
Who make the laws? Who made Bush president? Who believed the Confederate flag need to be flying? You talk about democracy and be lying. Who the beast in Revelation? Who 666? Who decide Jesus get crucified? Who the devil on the real side? Who got rich from the Armenian genocide? Who the biggest terrorists? Who changed the Bible? Who kill the most people? Who do the most evil? Who don't worry about survival? Who have the colonies? Who stole the most land? Who rule the world? Who said he good but only do evil? Who the biggest executioner? Who want the oil? Who want more oil? Who told you what you think that lady you find out is alive? Who found them lately? Maybe they Satan. Who paid the CIA? Who knew the bomb was gonna blow? Who know why the terrorists learned to fly in Florida and San Diego? Who know why 5 Israelis was filming the explosion and cracking their sides at the notions? Who need fossil fuels, so they ain't going nowhere? Who makes the credit cards? Who get the biggest tax cut? Who walked out of the conference against racism? Who killed Malcolm, Kennedy, and his brother? Who killed Dr. King? Who would want such a thing or be linked to the murder of Lincoln? Who invaded Grenada? Who made money from apartheid? Who kicked the Irish a colony? Who overthrew Chile and Nicaragua later? Who killed David Sabeco, Chris Hani, the same ones who killed Biko, Cabral, Neruda, Allende, Che Guevara, Sandino, who killed Kabila, the ones who wasted Lumumba, Mulane, Betty Shabazz, Princess Di, Ralph Featherstone, Little Bobby, locked up Mandela, Garuba, Geronimo, Asada, Lumia, Garvey, Dashiell Hammett, Althea Hutton. Who killed Huey Newton, Fred Hampton, Edgar Evers, Mikey Smith, Walter Rodney? Was it the ones who tried to poison Fidel? Who tried to keep the Vietnamese oppressed? Who put a price on Lenin's head? Who put the Jews in ovens and who helped them do it? Who said America first and okayed the yellow stars? Who killed Rosa Luxemburg, Liebknecht? Who murdered the Rosenbergs and all the good people? Iced, tortured, assassinated, banished? Who got rich from Algeria, Libya, Haiti, Iran, Iraq, Saudi, Kuwait, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine? Who cut off people's hands in the Congo? Who invented AIDS? Who put the germs in the Indians' blanket? Who thought up the Trail of Tears? Who blew up the Maine and started the Spanish-American War? Who got Sharon back in power? Who backed Batista, Hitler, Bilbo, Chiang Kai-shek? Who decided affirmative action had to go? Reconstruction, the New Deal, the New Frontier, the Great Society. Who knew Tom S. Clarence worked for? Who doo-doo come out the colon's mouth? Who know what kind of skeezer is a Condoleezza? Who paid Connolly to be a wooden negro? Who give genius awards to Homo Locus Subsidiary? Who overthrew Nkrumah? Bishop? Who poisoned Robeson? Who tried to put Du Bois in jail? Who framed Rap Brown, Jamil Alameen? Who framed the Rosenbergs, Garvey, the Scottsboro Boys, the Hollywood 10? Who set the Reichstag fire? Who knew the World Trade Center was going to get bombed? Who know who told 4,000 Israeli workers at the Twin Towers to stay home that day? Why did Sharon stay away? Who? Explosion Al. The newspapers say the devil's face could be seen. Who make money from war? Who make dough from fear and lies? Who want the world like it is? Who want the world to be ruled by imperialism and national oppression and terror and violence and hunger and poverty? Who's the ruler of hell? Who's most powerful? Who you know ever seen God? But everybody's seen the devil. Like an owl exploding in your life, in your brain, in yourself. Like an owl who knows the devil all night, all day. If you listen, like an owl exploding in fire, we hear the questions rise in terrible flame, like the whistle of a crazy dog, like the acid vomit of the fire of hell. Who and who and who and who and who and who? Thank you.
That was the poet Ameri Baraka at the December 9 Constitution Center event honoring Mumia Abu-Jamal. The December 9 Forum was co-sponsored by educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal, the National Lawyers Guild, and International Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We will now hear from attorney Michael Cord.
Before I get started, I'd like you all to give yourselves a rousing round of applause for supporting justice and Mumia Abu-Jamal. Having said that, I'm going to make sure that I stick to my 10 minutes because we got so many other speakers who have some powerful information to share. Three things basically I want to talk about, and I'll make sure I keep them within the 10 minutes. First is about juvenile law. You might ask, how does juvenile law have anything to do with Mumia's case? I'll explain that. Then I'm going to talk to you about the death penalty in general. And finally, I'm going to get into some specifics about Mumia's case. Many of you, I'm sure, listened to WRD 900 AM. And if you did, you heard the bullshit from Mr. Lynn Abraham, Seth Williams. But let me just get into the specifics right now. First thing in regard to juvenile law, the same system that tried to murder Mumia Abu-Jamal is the same system that puts kids in prison for life for longer than any other state in the United States. More than Texas, more than Mississippi, more than Alabama. And if you think it's bad that Pennsylvania has more juveniles as young as 14 years old serving life without the possibility of parole, more than any state in the country, and it gets worse. Pennsylvania has more juveniles serving life without parole than any state in any country on the planet. That's the same system that tried to murder Mumia Abu-Jamal. There are 450 juveniles, grown men now, many of them in their 60s, in their 70s, who made mistakes as kids, 14, 15 years old, and that system, that Pennsylvania criminal and justice system, that again, tried to murder Mumia, treats kids, most of them, poor white kids, black kids, and Latino kids. That's the same system we have to contend with. Let me jump now to my death penalty argument, because this is critical. Anybody, and I'm sure we have enlightened folks here, so I'm preaching to the choir, but those of you out there who think that there are situations where the death penalty is warranted, let me just make some brief arguments. The first argument is that if you believe in a God, if you're Christian, Muslim, Jewish, anything, if you believe in any God, then the death penalty is sinful. If you don't believe in God, it's immoral and unethical under every circumstance. Why? Why is it sinful? Why is it immoral? And why is it unethical? It's very simple. We as humans don't create life. We procreate. So something before us created life. If we didn't create life, we don't have the authority to destroy life. So to the extent that you support the death penalty, you're killing the creation of the Creator. And those who say, well, anybody on death row, they should be there because they committed a brutal murder. It's the eye for an eye concept. And I say, okay, on its face, eye for an eye does sound reasonable. But let's take it to its logical conclusion. If we believe in killing killers, then why don't we rob robbers? Why don't we kidnap kidnappers? Even better, because you know when you talk about the death penalty, there's a state employee that injects you with that lethal injection. So there's a state employee who gets paid through tax dollars to kill. If that's true, and it is, why don't we rape rapists? Why don't we hire a state employee whose job it is to rape convicted rapists? And you might say, well, that's obscene. That's outrageous. That's my point. If raping rapists is outrageous, then how much more outrageous is killing killers? It's all uncivilized. It's all barbaric. It's all inhuman. And it's all outrageous. And let me just wrap this up with a quick 3-4 minute discussion about why Mumia is not only, this is where the legal part comes in. We as lawyers come into court in criminal cases and we argue that our client is not guilty. When we say our client is not guilty, we're not saying he didn't do it. We're saying the prosecution can't prove it. There's a difference between being not guilty and being innocent. Not guilty means they didn't prove it. Innocent means you didn't do it. Well, in Mumia's case, here's a brother who's not only legally not guilty, but he's also factually innocent. And if you have a man who's legally not guilty and also factually innocent, it was a great day the other day when Seth Williams, announced that he wasn't going to seek the death penalty. That's a tremendous victory. But it's only half of it. Those of you who know football, it's pretty much we got to the red zone, but we got to score a touchdown. We got to get to the end zone. Red zone means nothing. That's not 3 points. It's not 2 points. It's not even 6 points. We want 7 points. A 7 point is a touchdown. Now, let me wrap it up by saying this. First of all, anytime you look at the criminal justice system, it's really a criminal injustice system. I don't have any faith at all in the way the system works. In fact, I always say that I don't go to court to get justice. As a lawyer, I don't go to court to get justice. I go to court to expose the injustice. And because that's my goal, I've never lost a case in my career because there's always injustice. But the interesting thing about Mumia's case is that even though Seth Williams has gone ballistic about these judges who in effect kind of ruled in Mumia's favor are not bleeding heart liberal left-wing judges. On the federal district court level, because the way it works in the federal level, you got the district court, circuit court of appeals, and Supreme Court. Well, the judges who ruled in Mumia's favor regarding death were not left-wing liberal judges. These were judges on the federal court appointed by none other than Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. If these right-wing racist fanatics can see the law halfway, what the hell is wrong with Mr. Lynn Abraham? Let me wrap it up in the last 2 minutes by pointing out some key facts about Mumia's case, because remember, as a lawyer, I'm not just saying he's legally not guilty, I'm saying he's factually innocent. These are the three strongest points you can use when you're debating with people. Remember these three key points. The first point has two or three parts to it. Anytime somebody uses a firearm to shoot and kill somebody, the first thing the police do is they get the bullet out of the body and match that bullet to the gun. Well, they had the officer on the ground, they had a bullet inside of him, and they had the gun they claimed Mumia had. They claimed Mumia had. Now, by the way, these points I'm making right now are not debatable. These are all facts from the case. So it's nothing anybody can say about me making these up. These are irrefutable facts. Well, when they tried to match the gun they claimed Mumia had to the bullet inside Faulkner, it was inconclusive. Inconclusive. Their words. You say Mumia, this crazy black revolutionary, just murdered this heroic white cop. You got this gun you claim was in Mumia's hands. You got the bullet in the officer's body. How could it be inconclusive? That's their point. The second argument, which is just as important, if not more, I do murder cases. I do death penalty murder cases. When my client shoots somebody and the police catch him instantly, the first thing they do is what we lawyers call a neutron activation test, a paraffin test. It's basically a gunpowder test. Well, you got Mumia right there on the ground. You claim he just fired a gun. Check his hands for gunpowder residue. Can you believe they said they forgot? They didn't check his hands. But they checked the jacket or the sweater Mumia had to find out that the gunpowder residue on his jacket came from Faulkner's gun. So if you could tell about the gunpowder on the jacket, why not the gunpowder on the hand? I believe they checked Mumia's hands. I believe it came back negative. But they couldn't say that. So they had to say, we forgot to check his hands. The final point. They claim Mumia had a gun. And the gun they claimed Mumia had was a .38 caliber. but the bullet inside Faulkner, from their own medical records expert, was a 44 caliber. Anybody who knows anything about guns know that a 44 caliber bullet can't fit in a 38 caliber gun. On the appellate level, when the question came up and the forms were shown to the medical examiner, 44 caliber, 38 caliber, he said it was a typo. He actually said it was a typo. There's an irrefutable fact. I'm going to wrap this up in 1 minute because we have other comments from other people. That's the first thing. And I got 1 minute. It's now 58 seconds. So I'll clean it up in 58 seconds. Other thing, during the closing argument, the prosecutor said that Mumia stood over the officer, execution style, fired a gun between his eyes. That's physically impossible. Why? Because the wound that Mumia sustained was a downward wound from his chest down to the stomach. If he had been standing over the cop, Mumia would have shot from the stomach up to the chest. In order for him to be shot from the chest down to the stomach, he could not, I repeat, could not have been standing over the cop. And finally, they claim Mumia said, "I shot the mother and I hope he dies." Well, that statement didn't even come out to 64 days later. 64 days later. And when they asked the officer, why did he wait so long? He said he was traumatized. This whole case is traumatized. Free Mumia.
That was attorney Michael Cord at the December 9 National Constitution Center event. We'll now hear from Mumia's daughter, Goldie.
There's a song called Trap Doors. Behind trap doors, you dig me? Dangerous, chaotic. The courts are bloodthirsty. America denies it. This is the end of living, beginning of surviving. My word only as strong as my actions are behind it. I come from a struggle most people couldn't imagine. At seven, I seen my family burning Babylon's ashes. The fact is, they want revenge for a crime never committed. Mumia ain't no killer, ask the deputy who did it. Listen, if your judge was your prosecutor's friend and you the defendant, how you think your trial gonna end? Exactly, as it did in this case, but with a twist of wickedness. Goldilocks about to give you the gist. On the night of the incident, driving the cab to pay the rent, a revolution fighter slash black journalist went out on the strip only to witness his kin. In the middle of a heated argument with one of Philly's finest, a crooked eyed white boy cop kid with a gun on a mission. As a pawn, they had to sacrifice one. Commissioner wrote up a list of officers for execution. Advanced tyranny allowed the government to do this. Got out the cab to see exactly what was happening. Cop got the hammer and shot him above the abdomen. Then radioed in for police backup. The wounded one fell. The other had to hold the get up. A couple minutes later, another gunshot reverberated through the block. 13th and Locust was hot. This time, the cop kid dropped, never to rise again and again. The innocent lives rely on the governor's pen. Concerning witnesses, or must we not get into this? Deadly interrogation came in and approached the bench, talking about, I'll let you work the street if we win. Just lie, and with a nod on her chin, she gave in. Testimony dictated by the FOP. Cynthia White, street walker that night, she walked free, but the lies she told placed a burden on her soul, let alone the evidence that they're trying to withhold. Behind trap doors, you dig me? Dangerous, chaotic. The courts are bloodthirsty. America denies it. This is the end of living, beginning of surviving. My word only as strong as my actions are behind. The legend said, here come the con man. He coming with his con plan to conquer and divide, have us killed and hypnotized, legal murder. Tears of blood, the warrior cried. Initially, that was the day they intended for him to die. For real, his only crime was the fact that he survived. Stuff for law, you know the difference from halal and haram. Sometimes I find myself wondering where the other man went. If it was three originally at the scene, oh say, can you see by the dawn's early light? So proudly we hailed the fall of Babylon tonight in preparation for invasion. A risky operation like a locksmith revealing secret safe combinations. The only thing stopping me is that I can't say what I want. If I do, I have to face the CIA the next day. And I ain't with it. Psych, but don't be deceived. Goldie will pump heat till destruction is complete. Die on my feet. Long before I live on my knees, I refuse to contribute to the American dream. He was beaten. I suspected the time of his arrest. But if we really free, then how can liberty be repossessed? Let me take that back. But if we really free, then how can liberty be repossessed? Then how could Mumia, with a hole in his chest, shoot the cop from that angle and supposedly confess? To me, it's a mess. Who wanna take the stupid test? What's greater, an ounce of justice or a pound of human flesh? I love y'all.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal's daughter, Goldie, at the December 9th forum.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go
to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.